Sunscreen is cancer-causing. Let that natural vitamin D on your skin.
Well, associating improper use of sunscreen with increased risk of skin cancer does not mean that sunscreen causes skin cancer. And it's important that we distinguish association with causality.
It's time to get loud. Welcome back to Loud Talk with Lavi, a podcast where we break down the walls of beauty standards one flaw at a time. And today I have a very special guest. Please welcome Dr. Danny Guo. Thank you so much for joining me on Loud Talk today.
It's my absolute pleasure to be here.
It is so exciting to have you here. I have so many questions for you, but just to start off, can you walk us through your experience and how you became a dermatologist in the first place?
So I grew up in Vancouver. As a first-generation immigrant, I came here when I was really young, but spending most of my time in Vancouver, I decided to go to UBC as an undergrad. Initially, I actually wanted to be a mechanical engineer for Ferrari. That was my childhood dream. I quickly realized that wasn't for me once things started to get a bit more real. I kind of found my passion for biology, which is what led me to doing a master's degree in experimental medicine afterwards. And through that, I was able to understand some of the integrations between science and medicine and decide to pursue medicine after that. I did medical school at the University of Calgary. During that time, I found a passion for dermatology through meeting a bunch of mentors and some of the nicest dermatologists in the country. And they inspired me to pursue that career. So then I did a residency back at UBC, after which I went to University of Toronto for a surgery fellowship specializing in skin cancer surgery. Wow. And then now I'm back in Calgary where this is where my home is now.
Wow, that is a crazy journey. I feel like you've been to every school in Canada at this point.
16 years. So it was a long journey.
Wow. I don't know how you had like the strength to go through all that schooling, but it definitely got you to where you want to be. So you didn't have like the idea to become a dermatologist from the get-go, which I think is cool to hear because especially with kids like now, like leaving high school and stuff, I think there's so much pressure to like know what you want to do. And I know for me, I was so lost in that. And then I ended up, you know, going into engineering at U of C. But before that, I was like, who knows? Like, we're just so like trained to just seeing these certain jobs out in the world. So did you ever think that you were going to like, after you said you had an interest in biology, did you think that you were going to end up in dermatology?
Not at all, actually. Yeah. At that time, I was really interested in basic science research and pursuing a degree in, like, PhD, essentially, in basic science research. The exact topic, I wasn't sure, but I really enjoyed doing research and I really enjoyed teaching. And I thought that working as a professor at the university would be kind of my ideal job. But during my master's degree, there was nothing wrong with that career path. It's just I developed this other passion. I really wanted to involve interpersonal interactions and working with people into my career more so than just teaching. So that's when I decided that medicine was probably a better career for me as opposed to basic science research. I mean, it's still very interesting. It's just that I would be in a lab for most of the year, except for the conferences that I go to present my work. So yeah, and definitely I didn't go into medicine thinking that I wanted to do dermatology either. I think dermatology is one of those specialties that people discover later after they go to medical school. Most people go to medical school thinking they want to be an internist or work in the ICU or be a surgeon or work in the eMERGE, right? Because these are the things you see on TV. These are the types of medicines that we are most exposed to. But certainly there's a lot of specialties that people come to discover after they start medical school. I think the average time people change their career goals in medical school is 5 times. So for me, it was like once or twice.
Very, very interesting. Yeah. And I'm out of curiosity, like growing up and stuff, were you into like skincare and stuff? Or was that more like, did you find the importance in it after you went to dermatology school?
So I actually grew up with eczema. And living in Canada, that's just extremely prevalent, right? You have eczema and then you live in Canada, so it just gets worse, especially during the wintertime. And I was one of those kids that just refused to put on any skincare because I just didn't like the way it felt or it was just icky. It was just weird to me growing up. But as I got older, I discovered that perhaps the products that I was using as a child weren't as geared toward people that with my skin condition, right? And my skin type, because they were always the greasier type, the earlier type, and nothing wrong with that. There's absolutely a time and place for that. But as I see in clinic a lot of young men especially, they struggle with wanting to put anything on their face because they just don't like the way it feels. And that was me. It was not until I started exploring some of the lighter products. Neutrogena Hydro Boost, not a sponsored statement or anything, but Neutrogena Hydro Boost was literally the first skincare product I ever used. It was so light, it was so nice. And that's kind of what opened my eyes to, oh, skincare isn't so bad after all.
Right. Yeah, no, for sure. I see it too, like with my boyfriend, my brother. It's like even a struggle for me to just see them apply the skincare, because seeing them apply it, like I don't know why they have to apply it one like so rough, and it's as if they're applying it like it's like this terrible thing for their skin. I'm like, you can just like apply it normally, you know? But I think it is like, I don't know, I just don't think that there are a lot of products that, you know, are very inviting for them to use, or they just associate it with like that, as you said, like that typical greasy feel of a moisturizer, or something like that. But it's interesting to kind of know your progression in that career. What would you say like was the most kind of mind-blowing thing that you learned about skin that you were like, oh my gosh, I didn't know? I don't know if that makes sense as a question.
I mean, the single most, I mean, now it's common knowledge and now it's very obvious to me, right? But I remember going through learning that the single best anti-aging ingredient out there is just sunscreen, right?
Yeah.
Like you think of all these other things like retinol, vitamin C, like oral collagen, and even some energy-based devices. Yes, they work really, really well, but the single most important and effective method of anti-aging is just sunscreen and sun protection in general.
Yep.
So when I learned that, it was transformative, right? Because it kind of took me away from a place that thought, well, skincare is just really, really expensive and complicated stuff. But the reality is, there can be a simplistic version for people who are looking for, you know, one or two products to just keep them going. You're going to get like 90% of the benefit from sunscreen, like religious use of sunscreen already. So everything on top of that is icing on the cake.
Yeah, absolutely. That actually brings me into some of the first few questions I want to ask you, because I think there's still so much misconception around sunscreen. I mean, I like cannot go a day without applying it. It could be the cloudiest day. Like I'm so
Good,
religious with
good.
applying my sunscreen.
Yeah.
But especially with, you know, being on social media, it opens the door to a lot of opinions. And just recently I made a video. It was an ad, but I made a video saying that sunscreen is my number one anti-aging tip, like you just mentioned here.
Great.
And
Love it.
I want to go through some of these comments with you and get your opinion,
Let's do it.
because the video is boosted, which I think always opens up to a new audience that, you know, maybe is not in the skincare realm.
Fair.
So top comment right here is from someone who said, when I had skin problems, I found that the more sun I had, the better my skin would be, and I never put all this stuff on my skin in a million years.
Ah, okay. So first of all, the comment section is wild sometimes, right?
Tell me
You
about
get
it.
sometimes when I see a video, and the thing I'm most excited for is just going straight to the comment section because, man, some of these comments are just hilarious.
I'm like, how do
But
people come, one, come up with some of these things, and two, like, think like, yeah, I'm gonna go with that.
yeah. So actually, this person's comment, I actually have some respect for because part of it is completely true. So we have a device in our clinic called narrowband UVB. It uses a very specific wavelength of UV to treat skin conditions. In fact, it can treat a number of different skin conditions, treat eczema, psoriasis, vitiligo, lichen planus, basically any, well, not any, but most inflammatory skin conditions. Can be treated with this, and it uses UV. I mean, that sounds mind-blowing, right? Don't dermatologists tell you that UV is bad? It's because UV isn't just one wavelength. UV is actually a whole spectrum of wavelengths. And some of these UV wavelengths can be beneficial, while others are not, and can, in fact, carry quite a bit of harm. And it's also a very controlled setting where we do this in the dermatology office. We know exactly how much energy you're getting. We know exactly how frequently you're getting the exposure that can lead to the best optimal result. Whereas when you go out in the sun, Yes, you're going to get some of those anti-inflammatory results from UV, but at the same time, it's an uncontrolled dosage. It's inconsistent exposure because you're going to be wearing some clothes here and there, and then the angle of exposure is not consistent. And you're also going to get some rays that are not helpful but are instead harmful, right?
Right.
So it's really a combination of things. Like, yes, you are going to get some benefit from those anti-inflammatory rays, but you're also going to get the other half. A common thing that I like to tell patients, and this is, I want it to be taken with a grain of salt here. Did you know that technically people who smoke have a slightly lower risk of getting ulcerative colitis?
No, why is that?
It's true. It's just a it's just an incidental thing that we know about. It's not a huge
Oh.
reduction of risk, but technically it's true. But you would never ever tell someone to go smoke cigarettes to reduce the risk of ulcerative colitis, right?
Right.
So it's really about the balance of benefits and harm. And in this case, the uncontrolled usage of the sun as an anti-inflammatory treatment is far more harmful than it is beneficial.
Wow, that was a great comparison right there. Really, really interesting fact. But I totally agree with you. And yeah, it's very interesting to know that, like, yes, there are those benefits, but maybe not at the cost. I have some more here for you. So someone said, honest question, how is putting chemicals on your face, then baking them in the sun good for you? I'm against sunscreen and putting anything on my face. I'm 50 and I've never used anything on my face.
I mean, I think everyone should have the ability to interpret the information that's given to them and then decide what to do with it. If someone chooses to not use anything on their face, even if I feel that that may be harmful for them, if they're spending a lot of time outside, ultimately it's up to each individual to decide. Yes, what she is saying is correct in that some ingredients, I don't want to say chemicals because like water is a chemical, oxygen is a chemical,
Yeah.
right? Some ingredients can increase sensitivity to the sun, which is why some of those ingredients we typically use at nighttime. The ones that we use during the daytime are more or less proven to be safe and, in fact, are meant to protect you from the harmful rays of the sun. I think the misconception that a lot of people have, in Western society at least, is that the sun is always helpful. People view sitting in the sun as a healthy, beneficial thing, both for physical and mental health.
Right.
While there, yeah, there may be some improvement to mental health, there is virtually no benefit to physical health that cannot be obtained through a safer means. For example, a common argument is, oh, I want to go in the sun because I want to get my vitamin D, right? Sure, that sounds great. Getting vitamin D is awesome. But what about all the negative effects of the sun in that case? Why don't you just take a oral vitamin D tablet, right? You can get a much higher, more controlled dose doing that as opposed to relying on the sun for this. So I would caution anyone, oh, I caution everyone from using broad terms like chemicals, right? That term is associated with a very negative connotation in Western conversations, but understand that everything is a chemical. Water is a chemical. Air is a chemical, right? Well, I mean, oxygen is a chemical. So yeah, I don't have much more to add to that particular comment except like be try not to generalize as much regarding what chemicals are, because some can be harmful and
Totally.
some can be beneficial.
Totally. I think people just see like chemical and they think like toxic, but then there's this whole push with
Yes.
like natural clean makeup and skincare, and it's very,
Oh, don't
which
get me started
we can
with.
get into that too, but I have one last sunscreen comment, which you kind of
Sure.
touched on
Yeah.
already. So someone said, sunscreen is cancer causing. Let that natural vitamin D on your skin, which you kind of addressed the vitamin
Yeah.
D situation
There
already.
is one additional nuance to that comment, though.
Yes.
When some people use that argument that sunscreen is associated with higher rates of cancer, I'm just going to turn that statement into a bit more of a scientific statement so we can discuss it a little bit more. That sunscreen is associated with higher rates of cancer. And this was argued by some researchers. I can't name the study off the top of my head, but some researchers were making this argument. But the reality of the situation is, in those cases, sunscreen gave, sorry, improper use of sunscreen gave a false sense of security and a form of a permission for people to bake in the sun. The sunscreen is just a shield that lasts up to 2 hours on your skin. If you don't reapply, if you don't apply appropriately, it's not going to protect you. And if it gives you the false sense of security for, oh, you're now allowed to go bake in the sun for 6 to 8 hours in a row because you're not going to get any harm. Well, then in that case, you are actually going to get harm. And associating sunscreen with, in, well, associating improper use of sunscreen with increased risk of skin cancer does not mean that sunscreen causes skin cancer. And it's important that we distinguish association with causality.
Right, absolutely. And I know I've seen a lot on the internet lately too, being like, well, our ancestors didn't use sunscreen and they were fine. They didn't have like skin cancer and this and this. Do you also think that this is associated with like life expectancy and that we are like living longer now, so we're seeing the effects of skin cancer and sun damage?
So excellent point. So that is one of the two reasons for why we are observing what that person is saying. One, because we are living longer, and the longer you live, the more any form of radiation affects you. And the sun is a form of radiation. So yes, the older you get, the more skin cancer you're going to see. But the second thing is we are just much better at detecting skin cancer now, right?
Oh.
There's this graph, I think, that shows the association with sunscreen rise and melanoma rise. So that's where people are saying, oh, sunscreen causes cancer. But the reality is, we became aware of the negative effects of UV and skin cancer at that time point. So people started coming out with sunscreens to protect you, but then we also became much, much better at detecting skin cancer. So I would actually argue that it's a combination of both of those things that may lead one to believe that, oh, we didn't have skin cancer 40 years ago or 50 years ago, but now we do, and that's because of sunscreen.
Absolutely. Wow. That I didn't think about like that second point, but that definitely is true. And I mean, I'm happy we debunked some of these comments here regarding sunscreen, especially since I struggle with acne. Everyone's like, if you just go out into the sun and let the sun dry up all your pimples, then your whole life
Oh.
will be so. And I'm like,
Oh
I'm still gonna protect my skin from the sun. I mean, don't get me wrong, I love the sun. As you mentioned, like the mental like benefits of it, like for me, I thrive in like a sunny environment, like I love summer and everything, so I definitely feel those effects. I always feel like the effects of like seasonal depression and stuff, but still gotta protect my skin from the sun nonetheless.
So to be totally fair, a lot of people automatically assume that dermatologists are basically telling you to never go into the sun, right? No
Yeah,
matter what. It's the most harmful thing in the world.
stay
That's actually
inside.
not the message. That's a distorted message. The message is to stay safe in the sun. If I told you to never go into the sun, why would I even talk to you about sunscreen? Just I would talk to you about bomb shelters and like cement roofs, right? So I believe in doing what you love, but just being safe about it. Like people die in car accidents every single day. I don't tell people to not drive. I just tell people to wear their seatbelts and obey traffic law, right? So it's just about doing what you love, but safely.
Absolutely. I love like all the like comparisons you make. It makes it very, very simple to actually follow. And I think for anyone who maybe is new to skin care, it's like, oh yeah, that makes total sense. So I love that. The next thing I want to get into, which we kind of touched on briefly, is the whole notion of like clean, all natural skincare and all of that. There's been, I mean, me on like the influencer side, the amount of emails I've gotten from different brands, and the like first line will be like, we're a like chemical-free like skincare brand, whatever, and I just sit there and I'm like, what do you mean you're chemical free? Like your first ingredient is water.
Does the bottle come with a vacuum inside with no chemicals whatsoever? Like you open it, you hear this whooshing sound as air goes in.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it has created this like fear like mongering in a lot of customers, especially when they see products with, let's say, like acids, even if it's like a hyaluronic acid, like that word just like scares people of just like seeing the ingredients. So can you kind of give your opinion on the whole like clean beauty notion that's going on?
So clean beauty is a marketing term. There is no scientific definition or consensus definition of what clean beauty means. It is purely for marketing, and it is capitalizing on this fear that of chemicals, essentially, of the word chemicals. That word is just so negative that, in fact, I think companies stop calling their sunscreen chemical sunscreen. In fact, they now call it organic sunscreen versus inorganic sunscreen because of the negative connotation that's associated with that word. And it's not only that word. I actually just posted something on social media as well about marketing terms in skincare and how some brands try to sell an emotion as opposed to sell a product, right? It makes you feel good, makes you feel natural, makes you feel clean. But these terms don't mean anything. Like, how does feeling natural, like, how do you measure that, right? So I would stay away from relying on those terms. If a brand uses those terms, but the product comes with good science and has excellent ingredients, there's nothing wrong with that. But I just
Absolutely.
wouldn't be blinded by or lured by such terminology that carries no scientific basis. And I think that's, at the end of the day, a very important component of choosing the right skincare is choosing ingredients that have evidence behind them, like scientific evidence, and using products that are honest about what their products can do, as opposed to just try to sell you a feeling.
Absolutely. And as you mentioned, like there are some brands and products that I love that maybe they do use those like marketing terms of clean, which I understand. Like they have to, stay ahead of the game. And like if that's what people want to buy, like that totally makes sense.
Their company, they have to make sales. I get it, right? But we just, it's
Exactly.
important that we kind of look past this as consumers if we want to be if we want to be smart with our choices.
Absolutely. And going off of that, can you tell me more? And this is like an area that I want to learn more on, so I want to get some of your knowledge on this. Is products being like non-comedogenic or products containing ingredients that, let's say, are comedogenic? What does that mean? And does that mean like those ingredients can be comedogenic if they're just included in a product, or does it have to be like just using that ingredient at like a, let's say 100%? What does that actually mean in the skincare terms?
So, do you know what a comedone is by chance?
Yes, it's like,
Right. Yeah, so just for the audience here, a comedone is essentially a blackhead or a whitehead. An open comedone is what we call a blackhead, and a closed comedone is what we call a whitehead. And these are the defining features of acne as a skin disease. So when brands call their products non-comedogenic, so first of all, brands will never call their products comedogenic, right? This is a comedogen that is never going to sell. So it's either not labeled or non-comedogenic. So non-comedogenic products, in order for them to get that type of label, they have to have some type of study or proof that their products are not more likely to induce comedones in patients than not using the product itself. So if they have that data, that means that it is safer for people with acne. But it's important to be nuanced with this, right? Like, they don't say 100% of people who use this do not have an increased number of comedones. It's always a percentage. So some people are still going to have to shop around and find the right product that doesn't cause a breakout for them. Now, non-comedo, sorry, products that don't say non-comedogenic, it doesn't mean that they're necessarily comedogenic either. It's just that they didn't take that extra step to prove whether their products will affect this population or not.
That makes a lot of sense, and thank you for explaining that, because I think that's a term that is thrown around a lot as well. And also like with that, like pore cloggers, for example, like if an ingredient, like let's say like shea butter, for example, people usually associate that with being a pore clogger. Is there a difference between like a product having like a percentage, like a small percentage of shea butter versus like applying just straight shea butter to the face? Like, does that make a difference in how much of a pore clogger it could be?
So I actually haven't seen that association as much with shea butter specifically. The ones that I do see as what people call pore cloggers are usually the ointment-based products. And that's because it literally forms a seal on top of the pore that doesn't allow the contents to come out. Now, the reality is this is a very individualized process. What clogs pores for one patient doesn't always clog pores for another. And it's not only the products that you're putting on your face that will determine whether you are at higher risk of getting comedones or not. It's the way you apply them as well. So if you are to use a very gentle cleanser on your face, it's probably not like one with SA even, right? The salicylic acid, it's probably not going to cause any issues with comedones. But if you were to use the same cleanser and scrub your face with that and use it three times, triple wash every day, twice a day, then you're probably going to get comedones from that alone, right? So it's not only the product, but it's how you are using it. So it's important to understand that whether a product is publicly perceived to have a higher risk of clogging your pores or not doesn't necessarily mean it'll apply to you. And you need to focus on more than just the product and also how you're applying it.
Right. That makes total sense. And that leads me into my next thing, which for me, I get very, very dry skin, especially like living here in Calgary. The
Me
winters are
too.
like awfully dry.
It's
And
terrible.
I'll often use like things like let's say like a petroleum jelly in like a slugging type of technique at night, which really helps with my dryness. And I personally have not found that that has like given me more acne or anything like that. If anything, it's
Oh.
maybe helped with like just the healing process of my skin by like locking in that moisture since my skin gets dry. And a lot of the times I get like ripped in the comments because people are like, this is clogging your pores, this and this and this. What are your thoughts on that and like using a petroleum jelly when you have acne?
So you can certainly, so this is a interesting topic because a lot of people have this perception that slugging is associated with increase of acne. It's actually not 100% true. So first of all, if you slug like that person on TikTok who I think made this whole thing viral in the first place, like that gigantic
Yeah.
glob of Vaseline, you're probably more likely to run into some issues, right? But that's not what real slugging is. Slugging just means applying a generous amount of occlusive ointment, like Vaseline or CeraVe ointment or Aquaphor after your moisturizer and actives to help lock in moisture.
Right.
Vaseline itself is not technically higher at a high risk of giving you breakouts by itself. You actually just have to cleanse properly beforehand and apply maybe a light moisturizer in your actives so you can have some water in the area and then lock it in with slugging. So it's a difficult thing to convince my patients because it's so intuitive, right? Oh my God, Vaseline's so thick, it's going to clog my pores. But the reality is it doesn't actually do it if you do your skincare routine properly.
Right. And I think from a lot of, these questions I'm asking you and a lot of responses, it really just, as you said, comes down to the actual proper use of products. And like you said, with the sunscreen too, right? You can't blame a product necessarily if you're using it without its intended use or
Right.
improperly, right? So yeah, that's
Exactly.
very interesting. And that's good to know because I always get slammed in the comments anytime I pull out Vaseline and I'm like, I
So
promise it's
you
not
actually
ruining my
use
skin.
Vaseline and it doesn't worsen your acne, right?
No.
Yeah, so that means you're doing your skincare routine correctly.
Yay.
Good job.
That's awesome to hear. Wow. Okay, let's talk about acne because I definitely want to talk about acne with you. So, I know when we first met, I touched on this a little bit, but I talked to you about how I found for me Accutane wasn't something that I was completely comfortable going on. And in my experiences, some of the doctors I had seen stuff, I felt like that pressure to go on Accutane or that like other solutions weren't even a possibility to look at. And one thing that I really resonated with you on is, you mentioned how it's so individualized and it really depends on each person's situation. So, what do you suggest for anyone who's maybe struggling with acne, and has been presented Accutane? They're just not sure if it is the right solution for them or not.
So, excellent question because this is a very common question, and for some people, it can be quite a touchy subject. Now, I don't want to make broad medical advice without
Right.
having seen each because, like, any type of medical advice should be tailored to the individual and their circumstances, health history, all this and that, right? But in general, proper care of acne needs to focus on more than just what prescription I'm going to sign for you. You have to look at multiple things. So, number one, you have to first start with proper skincare, what you do at home, right? So, don't overwash your face. Don't overscrub your face. Use a gentle cleanser, right? Use non-comedogenic products if you can. For your actives, try to use something hydrating, like a hyaluronic acid serum, along with an exfoliating serum, like salicylic acid, for example. So these are all things that are over the counter. And then make sure that you use your sunscreen and ideally pick one that's non-comedogenic as well, and that doesn't, in your particular situation, flare up your acne. Now, after this skincare component is done, then we can talk about prescription things and things that can be done in the clinic. And that can be broken down into prescriptions and devices, right? That can be done. So for prescriptions, for many people, they find that they try different prescriptions and it doesn't work for them. And the reason is when the doctor sometimes is prescribing their medication, they may not be considering the type of acne they have. So the most common, there's like 15 types of acne, right? But the
Oh,
most
wow.
common types of acne, there's like these weird variants with funny names in the textbook that we have to memorize in order to be a dermatologist. But anyways, I'll just talk about the basic ones. There's comedonal acne, right? Which is blackheads and whiteheads. And for some people, that's all they're ever going to have. It's just blackheads and whiteheads. There's inflammatory acne, also known as papulopustular acne, which is characterized by inflammatory papules like red bumps and pustules, right? Like what people traditionally consider as pimples, and the ones that they can pop is the pustules. And then there's the more severe variant, which is the nodulocystic acne that contains like big nodules, might have some deeper scars and have some cysts. And the treatment of each one of these is different. So it's important that you see ideally a dermatologist who can help you accurately determine what type of acne you have, and then give you a treatment that's targeted toward that. Now, the end spectrum of all of these different treatments is Accutane. Accutane, there's a lot of negative drama and reputation online, so I think that this may be kind of a this might be this part of this podcast that's going to get you some comments that we're going to have to answer at a later point. But Accutane is the only prescription treatment out there with a consistently known cure rate. In fact, we can tell you what the likelihood of cure, as in you're never going to have acne again for the rest of your life after a certain course of Accutane. That's the only medication that we have that good evidence of. Does that mean things like antibiotics won't, in some people, cure the acne and that they'll never have acne again? No, it will happen for some. It's just we don't have great data to support a specific percentage or a protocol that can lead to that. So that's why a lot of dermatologists and non-dermatologists resort to Accutane early, because we do know that in patients with acne, the longer you have it, the more likely you are to get scars and pigmentation, right? And then the more it's likely to affect your social well-being, right? Like with acne, a lot of people waste, no, I don't want to say waste, actually spend a lot of their time dealing with it, right? Like they spend time looking online. How do I hide this? How do I prevent this? What kind of diet should I try? What kind of skincare products should I buy? And they spend a lot of time and money on these things. And this whole time, it's impairing their ability to socialize for some people that feel embarrassed about it. It reduces their ability to engage in the activities that they want to engage in, just out of embarrassment, essentially. And it's because doctors kind of want to shorten that or reduce that impact on the patient's life as quickly and as much as possible that leads to a lot of them to give you Accutane or recommend Accutane very early in the treatment. And while that's right for some people, it's not right for everybody. There are other prescription options out there. And once again, you have to see the dermatologist to figure out which one works best for you. But for someone who's not interested in Accutane, I would recommend starting with a topical medicine, like that's like a topical version of Accutane, and go from there. Now, the energy-based device is newer in the acne treatment world. And there is some good evidence that some of them can work very well. But once again, it's very individualized. What works for a group of people doesn't mean that it works for 100% of that group, right? It could be like 70% of the group or 40% of that group. And if you're not in that 70 or 40%, then it's not going to work for you. And the unfortunate reality with a lot of energy-based devices for anything really is it's incredibly expensive. So lots of doctors don't go down that route in terms of recommendations right away, before trying all these other like less expensive, more affordable options. So yeah, like we run into this trouble of coverage and tailoring it to the patient. And it's just important that ultimately you see a dermatologist if you have acne early, and then just have an honest discussion of what works for you. But yeah,
No,
I
and
felt like I went on a really long spiel
no.
there.
I think it's important to talk about, and I mean, yeah, you brought up like energy-based devices. I mentioned to you when we met that I had done like three treatments of AviClear, and the way it was positioned to me was very much like this is like a 100% guarantee, like you'll get rid of your acne. And after, I mean, I didn't go into it thinking, okay, yeah, because I've had acne for like 10 years now, I'm very, with any new product or treatment, I'm very like, I'll believe it when I see it type of thing. Like, I'm like, I'll try it.
And that's a good attitude to
But
have.
I'm not going into this thing because I used to do that. I'd buy a new product, as you mentioned, like spend my time and money getting a new product and then having this like huge disappointment when it didn't work. So now I'm very much like, I'll try it, and if it works, it works. If it doesn't, oh well, right? So that's kind of how I was with AviClear. But yeah, for me, like, it's been almost a year since I finished the treatments, and for me, I didn't find that it improved or worsened my, it literally, I didn't find that it did much for me. And not saying that the treatment doesn't work at all, but I think the way it was positioned, it was very much like, this is 100% guarantee that it'll work
Yeah,
for everyone.
so this is PSA for everyone. Anytime someone tells you in medicine or skincare or something like that something works 100% of the time, it's not true. They're exaggerating, right? There's nothing in medicine that's 100%, right? Except for all of us probably being dead 200 years from now, right? Like other than that, it's yeah, I would take 100% with a very large grain of salt.
Yeah, no, that's definitely very important to do, especially with skincare because it's so individualized. I do have a question because you mentioned like the type of acne and treating it is so important. And with Accutane, like for example, if someone goes on it and does have an acne relapse, does that mean they have like a different type of acne than someone who never gets acne back after going on Accutane?
So before I answer that question, I'm going to throw in a quick segue with going on Accutane. So the proper dosing of Accutane has a very specific definition. You actually have to complete, let's say, 120 to 150 milligrams per kilogram of your body weight of Accutane over however long in order for it to be considered a true course. And if you finish that course, often the number that's quoted is you will have up to 70% chance of never having acne again for the rest of your life if you finish that course. But that 70% means that 30% of the people are still going to have acne afterwards, right? And you can still go on a second course of Accutane afterwards in order to have more benefit, or like go for another 70% chance of cure. So for your question, for people who are of that 30%, assuming that they did do a proper course of Accutane, it doesn't mean that they have a different type of acne, right? They could have the same type, they're just not of the 70%. But even if they did have a different type of acne, it doesn't matter because Accutane basically works for all types of acne.
Oh, okay, I see. And is there something that would differentiate, like, would you be able to tell if a patient is going to more likely be in that 70% or that 30% group, or is that something where you just have to see how it kind of plays its course?
I mean, I don't have any evidence-based answer to that, but like off the top of my head. But I would imagine that the more severe your acne is, the more likely you're going to get a relapse. Not every person with severe acne that I put on Accutane has had a relapse. In fact, most people haven't. But I would imagine that to be the case. And if you've tried Accutane before and you relapse, and if I were to do another course of Accutane, then I would argue that your chance of relapse is higher. Just because it failed once. But other than that, I don't have evidence off the top of my head on the success rate.
I see. And how much is like acne related to, for example, like hormonal imbalance, like inconsistent sleep, stress levels, all of that, diet?
So stress is related to everything, right? Like every single condition out there to some degree is related to stress. And while we like to talk about stress management. Ultimately, that's a very individualized process. Like I work as a skin cancer surgeon and a dermatologist full time. I have to run a clinic with more than 50 staff in it. It's stressful. And if that causes me to have acne, I want to reduce my stress, but how am I going to do that?
Easier
So
said than done.
yeah, exactly. So stress plays a role and how much we can manage it is it's very, very difficult to say. Now, foods is a very common and also somewhat provocative discussion for how it relates to acne. People are going to say online that certain foods trigger acne in them all the time, or even patients that I see in clinics are like, every time I have this food, it provokes acne in me. And even though there may not be any scientific evidence or scientific consensus that that food can trigger acne in a population, if it does in you and it consistently does in you, I'm going to believe you Because once again, all these studies, all these population analyses refers to the population, not to the individual.
Right.
So yes, if you believe that every time you eat something consistently, you get acne, and when you stop eating it, you don't get acne anymore, then acne is probably related to that food item for you. Now, that doesn't apply to everyone, so I strongly caution against going on TikTok or social media and listening to people saying, "I cut this out of my diet and I stopped getting acne." I'm actually inclined to believe that person for them, but I would not generalize that on everybody else. Now, the foods that do have some degree of evidence for like provoking acne, it's like weak evidence, is not amazing, right? Is high glycemic foods, right? Foods with high glycemic content. So, for example, one of the things that we would be surprised about when we read about it in our textbook is skim milk. Skim milk, you would think, why would skim milk provoke acne? Well, because the glycemic content, glycemic index of skim milk, I believe, okay, nutritionists, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that the glycemic index of skim milk is actually higher than like full fat milk or 2% milk or something like that. So there is some association between that and acne, but other than that, there's not really much else. There are certain medications that are associated with provoking acne, and those are well-documented side effects of those medications. But yeah, I mean, sleep is more related to the stress thing as well. But sleep is not so much the lack of sleep as what you're sleeping on sometimes can also provoke acne.
Definitely. Yeah, I switched to like a silk pillowcase like years ago, and I feel like that made a even not even just like the material itself, but like, well, the I feel like the feeling of the material too, because it was just like less rough on my skin, especially when I had like really bad cysty acne. But talking about the food too, it's so funny that I get all these comments online, and I really just laugh at a lot of them because they assume that they know like everything I put into my body, and people will be like, oh, if you just stopped eating like garbage, you wouldn't have acne. And then I'll show, like, I'll do like what I eat in a week, and then the comments turn to like, oh, you eat really healthy. And I'm like, I promise I'm not like
You can't
rubbing
win,
on
right?
my face. Yeah. Or like, I even because for me personally, as you said, it's very personalized. Like for me, I found like, yeah, whenever I would consume like a lot of dairy or a lot of sugar, I usually break out. And even things like alcohol, like even just a couple drinks for me, I found I would wake up in the morning with some breakouts, which could maybe be due like dehydration, you know, the other effects. But I stopped drinking like a year and a half ago. Like I cut out alcohol out of my life completely because I'm like, I don't see
Me
any
too.
benefits for this. And
Yeah,
like,
me too.
I'm like, my skin is not, you know, any better. And honestly, like, I feel like I'm so much more energetic and like more of a life of a party without it. But I'll get
Yes.
comments where people will be like, oh, like you probably just drink a ton and all this. And I'm like, funny enough, I don't drink at all. Like, so clear, you know, but it is very individualized. But yeah, I always found like I would have like a drink or two and I'd break out the next morning. Or even like if I took like Tylenol when I was sick and stuff, like that would make me break out too. So it's very interesting how it's like everyone has certain things that can just trigger their acne
Yes.
very
I do
frequently.
believe in advocating for everyone to look out for their own health and to pay attention to how their body responds to certain things. There are lots of people, not only relating to acne, but just in general when it comes to food advice on TikTok and diet advice, is there are people who will tell you that I do this one crazy diet and I get these amazing results. Even if it were true, some of them I'm very hesitant to believe, but even if they were true, that certainly may not apply and probably doesn't apply to everybody as a population. So I just caution people to take healthcare advice, especially very broadly consuming, life-changing healthcare advice from individuals that aren't credible for giving it.
Absolutely. I just saw on TikTok the other day, like eating like raw garlic however many times a week to clear my cystic acne, and I was like, oh, that's interesting.
Sure, I mean, if it works for them, it works for them. But I don't recommend everyone try,
Well, it's
especially if you don't
become
like
like
garlic.
a trend now. Like people are like trying it to clear their acne. And I think it also goes down to like with acne, like I mean, I've experienced this. You just become so desperate to like try anything, you know, like
Yes.
literally you'll try anything. Even if you hate garlic, you'll eat garlic every day if that is the miracle cure for your
Yes.
cystic acne.
And
So I think
that's
it's,
how
yeah.
much impact it has on our society. I think there was a study in 2019 that looked at 204 countries in the world between 1990 to 2019, so like a 29-year span, 29, 30-year span there. And they measured what's called a daily adjusted life, sorry, disability adjusted life years. Basically, that means in total, how many years of life are lost to disability, to a condition? And in acne, the number was 5 million. So 5 million disability adjusted life years over a 30-year span of 204 countries. So that's like,
Wow.
it's a massive number. It just tells you how prevalent and impactful acne is. And a lot of, and this is why the comment section is wild, right? Like when someone posts something and then someone talks, gives them a recommendation, someone like thinking that like, oh, garlic helps you, right? Let's say someone said that in the comment. And a bunch of other people come in and attack them. At the end of the day, I think it shows how desperate people are and how much they care about this particular topic, because it is one of the most impactful and prevalent skin conditions, not even just skin conditions, in the world. And I think it's important to give respect to each other, that some things may work for individuals, but at the same time, take general healthcare advice with a heavy grain of salt.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think, I mean, that's why I kind of started creating so much of the content I do, is because acne did take up so much of my headspace and really controlled my confidence and just the way I lived my life too. I felt like it really defined me. So I kind of had to flip that switch and completely like take back my control, which like I think posting about it and being open on social media actually helped me do that, by also like empowering other people. But I see it so much in my comments, and that's why I started this podcast too, is just like helping other people, because I didn't grow up with acne being something that was normalized and like talked about in media. And I never want to say like acne is normal, because there's always like something behind it for why it's caused. But I think just being more open, like normalizing talking about it, and normalizing that almost everyone in the world is going to experience acne at one point or another. Like it shouldn't be this huge thing we're ashamed of to have as like humans, and we can talk about it. So that was like the whole reason on why I started doing this on social media and stuff. But the whole headspace thing that you talked about, and that 5 million number is actually insane, but I believe it, because I've gone through it and I see it in my comments too. Like so many people, saying no to plans, saying no to vacations, and just like beating themselves up all day long
Oh
over
no.
their acne. Like I've done it too, where I've gone out, and the whole time I'm just thinking like, oh my gosh, is everyone looking at my skin? I've made a lot of progress since then, but it's definitely, I think, one, like it's so crazy, because at the end of the day, when you really step outside of it and look at it, it's like, okay, they're just like some spots on my face. It's not like that serious. But when you're in it and like it's so painful and everything, it really takes up everything. And I sometimes get comments from people who maybe haven't experienced acne, and they're always like, why do you always talk about your acne experience and this and this and this? And I'm like, it's because it impacted my life so greatly that I know how much it's impacting other people, and that's why I want to speak on it.
I think it's a very important message, especially when you're talking about things like scars and normalizing the acne, because I don't know if you know this, but in Canada, let's just localize it. When you look at people between age 12 to 24, did you know that 80% of them have acne?
Yes,
And
yes.
if you look at adolescence, if you narrow that scope even further, just to adolescence, it's 90%.
Yeah,
So you
that's
are
insane.
speaking to a large population, and I think it's an important message to spread. And I'm very, very proud of you. Like, I've looked at some of your content and how honest you are with sharing some of the impact of acne in your life. And that's just, it's amazing.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And yeah, and for me, like I as you did mention, like why some derms are so quick to suggest Accutane to avoid the scarring. Like I went through that, the doctor I saw, it was just like my like nearby clinic. Like it wasn't a dermatologist, it was just like a family doctor. But he did suggest like, let's go on Accutane right away. And for me, I didn't feel like it was the best fit. And a concern for him was the scarring. But in that moment, I already made the mental decision for myself that the physical, like maybe effects that I'll have from Accutane, and the personal effects that I had when I went on hormonal birth control, those did not outweigh the benefits of me not scarring. So I had to like make that choice on my own. And now I am left with a lot of scarring. But at the end of the day, like for me, the scarring is not painful, it doesn't like throb on my skin and keep me up at night. Like, so not that I could care less. Like, obviously, there's still some days where I look in the mirror and I'm like, man, like, I do miss the skin I had before I had all the scarring, but it's also like just a part of my journey. And, all things just take time to heal. And maybe, yeah, like my skin won't go back to how it was before I had all that cystic acne, but, I'm happy that I was still able to like go through that healing process. And I don't know, maybe I would have done it like differently another way, but that's kind of the path I decide to take in that moment. And when people do tell me, like, oh, you're just an Accutane hater and this, I'm like, no, like, it's so personalized. And I would never say, like, don't go on it. It's the worst thing ever, because I didn't go on it. I don't know the experience with that. I just think it's kind of up to everyone. And I get a lot of people in my comments, like, every day. It could be a video that's not even about my skin at all. It could be like a new, like, check out these new clothes I bought, whatever. And people are like, go on acting. It's just like always. And I just find it so interesting that people are, so angry at me for not choosing to go on Accutane. And I'm like, at the end of the day, like,
Oh, no,
it's
no.
you're not like I don't understand sometimes how my acne bothers other people so badly. And I think it does come down to a lot of people not understanding how I can be like comfortable in my skin, even if I have like acne and acne scarring. I think that is what it comes down to, and why they're kind of like projecting those comments onto me. But yeah, I do think that's, I mean, it is the number one reason I talk about it, because growing up, like, I never saw that, and I always saw like having acne as like the worst possible thing that could happen to you, and you had to like hide it from the world always.
Well, Lovey, if you don't mind me asking, have you tried or like are you interested in treating the scars?
Yes, and I know that we had a little bit of a discussion on this when we met. Definitely, I'm not like, I need to get this done tomorrow. Like, it doesn't honestly bother me that much. And I have a lot of like indentation, I would say, especially like in my temple region stuff. So like when, I turn a certain light, you can see it more or less. But yeah, it's not something that bothers me a lot, because I can't feel it, and I think I do try to look at the positive of it every day, of like, it's a constant reminder to me of like what I've gone through. Because when I do get a flare up here and there, and if I do get a little bit in my head and insecure about it, I like see those scars and I'm like, girl, you went through way worse acne than this in the past. Like, you're good. Like, don't let this bring you down. So it is a little bit of that reminder for me. But I would say, like, in, the grand scheme of things, yes, like I do use different things in my skincare and stuff that help with pigmentation and all of that. But I do know that the actual like indented scarring will probably have to be like a grander treatment than like a topical skincare product.
So, absolutely. And first of all, I just want to say you are very, very strong in
Thank you.
the experience you have and the way you're talking about this. You have come to terms, at least to some degree, with some scars you have, and you're not letting it stop you from doing you, essentially. So, I think that's amazing, right? I've seen a lot of patients with acne, and for some people, they're not able to come out of they're not able to come to terms essentially with the sequelae of acne. And we have to understand that acne is not a choice, right? Acne is something that happens to us. And the good news though is that these days, I mean, every day technology improves and there are better and better treatments out there for people with acne scars, for yourself or for anybody that's listening that struggles with acne scars. So I think even if, let's say, 5 years ago, you tried something, it didn't work, and the doctor told you there was nothing better at the time, it doesn't apply today. And it won't apply 5 years from now because things are always evolving. And acne scar is a huge focus for a lot of dermatologists and development of people who develop energy-based devices. So, absolutely, if that is something that people are considering, there are great options out there. Now, nothing works 100%, right? Like I just said, if anybody says 100%, they're exaggerating. Nothing works 100%, but certainly some things are worth trying. And it all starts with an in-person assessment with a dermatologist who does this kind of stuff. Now, not every dermatologist treats acne scars, and not every dermatologist, actually, most dermatologists don't have everything under the sun, right, in their office. So it's just about finding the right person and having an honest chat with them.
So obviously there's a ton of different like scar treatments out there. And I know when we chatted originally, you said like the issue is a lot of people don't know which treatment treats which type of scar. So can you kind of give an outline of like the main types of scarring and maybe like the treatment that people should maybe try out for those different types?
So there are far more than I can fully cover. And I'm sure there are some treatment type out there that I don't know about because different things are approved in different countries. And, Turkey might have something that we don't have here. But the broadest terms, Acne scar splits into two major categories, the hypertrophic scarring and the atrophic scarring. Hypertrophic scarring means scars that stick out, and atrophic means the ones that go in, right? So when you mention indentation, that would be the atrophic type of scarring. So hypertrophic scars are usually either just classic hypertrophic scars in which, they stick out a little bit, or keloidal scars, which are true keloids that form on the face after acne, or on the chest or on the back after acne. And keloids different from normal scars in that they expand beyond the site of the initial injury. So for example, if you cut your skin, right, like just a cut right here, you would expect to get a scar right there and not for it to go farther, right, like up your elbow or anything like that. And so when scars expand beyond their initial site, they're called keloids. So that's what a keloidal scar would be. In both of these cases, our options are actually kind of limited. In the very extreme scenarios, surgical revision, like surgically removing a scar, may be the best option. But in most cases, injection of a steroid, a localized steroid, right into the scar to thin out the scar, injection of another chemical called Effudex, which is traditionally actually used as a topical chemotherapy. So it sounds very extreme. But in very low doses, it actually works for keloids as well. And using lasers like pulse dye laser, which is a vascular laser that destroys the blood vessels in the scar, and hopefully that can help flatten it quicker, and it can also reduce the redness of the scar, are the main options for treatment of hypertrophic scars. Now, for atrophic scars, it gets a little bit more complicated. The three types of atrophic scars that are most commonly seen in acne are pitting scar or ice pick scars, right? Boxcar scars and rolling scars. None of these are that obvious, right? So if you see a very obvious pit in the skin, it's like someone took a microscopic ice pick and just whacked your face with it. That would be an ice pick scar.
That's what I
Those,
have for sure.
yeah, those are best treated either with a small local excision, like you take a little circular punch biopsy and you just punch out that scar and you stitch together, and you replace the pit with a thin, like a 2 millimeter line or something, which often fades, not fades completely, but fades enough over time that it's easier to hide than an actual pit in the skin. Or using something like TCA Cross, which is a high concentration, high potency, but very localized chemical peel that you put right into the hole. It will turn white, it will scab, and then hopefully it will scar flat.
Oh,
So
interesting.
those would be the two main options of treating an ice pick scar. For a rolling scar, rolling scars are when your face, if you look at it from the side, kind of looks like this, right? Like hills and troughs. To treat those, you have to understand that often they happen because of tethers. So when a very big cyst or a inflammatory lesion of the skin causes inflammation deep into the skin, sometimes it can form a tether attaching the skin to the underlying fat or underlying structures. So that skin is pulled down, and that's why you see this kind of rolling scar. Of course, there's altered collagen and all that as well, but I'm just simplifying the process here. In that case, I'd like to check patients for tethers in their skin, like through a clinical examination. And if they do have the tethers, I actually do what's called subcision with a little bit of hyaluronic acid, like a sheet of hyaluronic acid underneath. Now, a subcision is when you use often a blunt instrument, not a sharp instrument, like a long needle, but it's actually blunt at the end. And you go underneath and you kind of cut all those adhesions between the skin and underneath. But if you just did that and then just let it heal, sometimes it'll heal just fine. But it's inflamed after the cutting, and you leave that alone, it's just going to attach again right away, right? So actually use a little bit, and many people do this as well, use a little bit of hyaluronic acid right there underneath to form a sheet to prevent them from connecting again, to reduce the risk of reattachment. And I do that before I do any surface treatments like lasers and whatnot, because I find that the tethers ultimately prevent it from healing right. So that would be the way I would treat rolling scars. First start with the subcision, followed by something like CO2 laser resurfacing or
Interesting.
intradermal injections of hyaluronic acid. The third type of scar is like a boxcar scar. So imagine a fresh field of snow in your backyard and like on Christmas Day or something. And then you just took a cardboard box, you threw it on the snow, and then you just pushed it, and then you took the cardboard box away. That shape, that's what a boxcar scar would look like. The ones that kind of look like this. In that case, you have altered collagen. like the collagen in the skin is kind of disorganized, and you also have loss of collagen. So the collagen is brought back down. So the most common way to treat this is actually to start with CO2 laser resurfacing, which punches microscopic holes in the skin and allows the collagen to regenerate itself. And then with this, there's a number of different injectables that you can use to try to stimulate some of that collagen to come back. The most commonly used one is what's called skin boosters, or very light intradermal hyaluronic acid that's placed in micro droplets in the skin. This is not a filler, so don't misunderstand that. But there are a number of other ways that you can regenerate some of that collagen as well. But as with any of these treatments, one treatment often is not going to be enough. You're going to need, especially if you have very severe scars, you're going to need multiple sessions over time. And I typically tell patients that go on this journey with me, that this is going to be a 1.5 to 2 year journey that we're going to have to go on together slowly. Because when you do a laser treatment, for example, you're not really seeing the effects of it until months afterwards, anyways. And then only after those, let's say 4 to 6 months, would you do another treatment if needed. And then you got to wait another 4 to 6 months. So you see how this can take a long time.
Yeah, it's definitely not no overnight. That was so interesting to hear about all the different types, because now, like, I mean, I definitely think I do have some like ice pick scars, especially on the side here, because it like right as you described it. But then as you were describing the other kinds, I'm like, maybe I have like some of those other kinds on like different parts of my
People
face.
usually
Just
have a mix of all three of them.
yeah, because I've definitely like I found I got like more of the like huge cystic breakouts like definitely around like my mouth and lower jaw. So I think the rolling scar is definitely a better way to describe like what's going on over here. So very, very interesting, because I think scarring sometimes with acne is like not even as talked about as like acne, and that's a space that's slowly starting to be more talked about in itself. But people are so focused on like treating the acne and with obvious reasons, but then no one really talks about like the impacts of how like acne scarring can make you feel, because it's like, okay, you
Oh,
put in all
yes.
this work
It's
to
lifelong.
clear this acne, and then it's like, oh, well, now I'm left with all this scarring that can't just be cleared maybe with like a topical treatment, as like let's say your acne could be in some cases. So it's definitely very impactful, and I think it's like that, yeah, it's a literal scar of like where all your acne used to be. And for some people, I mentioned that like more positive mindset I've tried to have with like the reminder of my acne, but I definitely was in a place before where I'm sure a lot of people can relate to, of the scars are a constant reminder of like all the negative, and all like the hard stuff you had to go through with your acne, and it just feels like a never ending cycle. So yeah,
It's
no,
very
that was
impactful for sure. And I encourage anybody with acne scars that are interested in having treatment to go seek out a healthcare professional that, ideally a dermatologist that's close to where you are, and chat with them, and but just have an understanding of the complexity of acne scars, and that sometimes people go to the doctor hoping that there's that one miracle drug that's just going to fix everything. But as I outlined, there are like 5 or 6 different treatments depending on which type of scar, and chances are you have a little bit of everything, right? So the reality is you can't expect just to have one treatment of a single modality that's going to just be the end all and be all of acne scars. It's a process and it's a journey.
Absolutely. Yeah, long, long journey. Acne in itself, it's a long and complex journey that you have to be prepared for. For the next topic here, I want to ask you about some like at home skincare devices, mainly like high frequency ones and like microcurrent devices, and as well as like LED masks, because I know those are questions I get a lot on my pages as well.
Did you have any specific ones you want to talk about first?
Yeah, so maybe let's start with the high frequency ones. So are ones that you can buy at home first, like is high frequency actually effective? I've personally used like an at-home one. I feel like it does help me with like when I have those really painful like cystic breakouts. I don't know if it's like a placebo thing or not, but I want to get your thoughts on that, and with like the at-home high frequency ones
Sorry,
specifically.
which device is this? Because when you say high frequency, I think of high frequency ultrasound, which is actually used for other things in clinic and not so much for acne. Which device are you referring to specifically?
It's like one of these ones.
Oh, I'm not familiar with this one. So,
Okay.
I
It's like
mean,
the they're like the argon. They have like argon inside them, and then you like plug it in.
so it's like a light therapy then. It looks like maybe it's an LED.
It like kind of like zaps your skin when you like apply it on.
I actually am not familiar with that one, so I don't want to make any silly comments about it. But there's a the problem is there are too many at-home devices, and if their energy is below a certain threshold or certain parameters are below a certain threshold, the line the process to get them approved is far less rigorous than some of the more intense devices that we would have in a dermatologist clinic, for example.
I see.
But the problem is the lower the energy, the lower the those parameters are, the less likely they're going to have any effect. At the end of the day, I mean, do you mind me asking how much was that device?
Like maybe $100,
Yeah,
maybe less.
so
Yeah, like
I mean
80 to
that
100, I
they
think.
make these very affordable so that people can buy them, but I don't know about that device particularly, but I would strongly recommend looking up evidence for this device and not just from the company's own website. Right? Because there's obviously a strong bias if you do that.
So what
But
about like LED masks, like at home ones? Like, are there
Yes.
any at home LED masks that actually could be effective, or is that just like not possible with like an at home device?
So I think this is actually a great topic because, first of all, LED devices have been used in some dermatologist clinics for the exact same reasons that they are used at these at-home masks. But the main difference between the two are twofold. One is the output of the device, right? Like obviously the big machines in the office are going to be way more potent than the mask that you have at home. It's just the way it is, right? The second is coverage. So can the masks, so when it comes to coverage, the LED masks that sit on your face, they're actually pretty good. But then there's also other LED devices out there that come in a wand that you put on different parts of your face. Those are not as good because how are you going to accurately determine how much energy you delivered to each spot that you had to put the wand on,
I
right? So
agree. I agree with
the
the wands
masks.
and stuff. Those ones always were like, I don't know about that. 'Cause a lot of people use them like kind of like how they would like a roller, like a face roller. And I'm like, you're literally
You're
touching it for
barely
like a
getting any
second.
exposure.
Yeah, but
You
I
need
have
like
tried.
20 minutes of direct exposure on each piece of skin for that to work. So
That'll
that's
take a
like
minute.
hours and hours and hours, right? So might as well just get the mask. So back to the masks, we don't have any evidence on the at-home masks themselves, but based on the technology, the wavelengths that are used, the science is there for the in-clinic devices. And because this isn't a laser that requires a very specific high energy output, they're just LED lights, right? They may not be as bright as the LED lights or have as much luminosity as the LED lights that we have in the clinic, but with enough exposure, theoretically, they should work. There are some that work better for acne, there are some that work better for rosacea, some for collagen. So I just recommend if you're going to invest in an LED mask, expect to invest $400 or so for some of the better ones, or more actually, for some of them, and try to get one, if possible, that has multiple colors, just so that you can use the different colors for different indications. Red is the one that is consistently talked about and used the most because it has the best evidence. So I actually think that if you have $400 that you want to invest in collagen promoting treatments. This is one of the main benefits of the masks for me is collagen promoting treatments. Then yes, absolutely. Because some of the growth factors out there, like one of my personal favorite growth factor serums for the skin, the Skin Medica TNS Advanced Serum, is 300 something dollars already, right? So that you can use up that. I mean, that's a great product. And if that is within your budget, you should invest in it if you're looking for a growth factor serum. But if you don't want to buy that every few months and you kind of want to buy one thing that's going to last you a long time, get the mask. It's a big upfront cost, but it doesn't have an expiry date. It doesn't run out at some point. LED bulbs last longer than you and I do, right? So
Well, that's the thing.
it's a good investment, I think.
Okay, interesting. I have a few of them, so it's definitely like reassuring to
You
know
have a
like
few of
I
them.
mostly because like some of them have been
Oh, this is
sent to me,
sponsored?
so
Okay, I'm like, wow.
no, I didn't just spend like multiple grands on these masks, but I was always like I've used them, and for some of them I'm like, yeah, I see like some of the effects, but I'm like, is this actually doing what it would what it's supposed to be doing? So that's good to know. And what about like a microcurrent device?
So microcurrent devices at home don't have as much evidence. And in the rare case, I've heard people getting pigmentation from them from like
Really?
just being just being discharged inappropriately. But I think that was probably more of a faulty device than anything.
Okay.
But what are you trying to achieve with a current device at home, for example?
I don't personally use one. I have a couple that like I just have
Were
laying
sent
around.
to you? Such luxury.
No. But I don't know. Like I'm like I see people, using them in the morning, kind of part of like a deep, maybe a depuffing routine and such. And I've used a couple of them. Like I would say I more like just the actual experience of using them. I thought it was a nice experience, but I can't say I've used one consistently to be like, okay, I'm trying to achieve a certain result out of it.
So these devices, along with many other similar ones out there, maybe an unpopular opinion, maybe I will never get sent one by one of these companies after saying this, but a lot of this is more placebo than anything.
Okay, interesting. Interesting.
These devices don't have robust studies to prove that they work. And when there's a lack of evidence, it doesn't mean that they don't work. It just makes me wonder, is it worth the money?
Right.
So if it just like all those treatments we talked about before, if it works for you and it makes you feel good and it does wonders for your skin, go ahead and do it. But as someone who speaks about skincare products and skincare routines and skin conditions online, I don't feel comfortable broadly endorsing any one particular product unless it has good scientific evidence. And at the end of the day, not only do I, speak on social media, I'm also a dermatologist in real life. So I would like to be a bit more cautious with things that I endorse because I think it carries certain weight.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's why I wanted to ask some of these questions too about the devices, 'cause I'm like, which one of these actually work and are worth the money, right? Because like it's different when if I'm like getting sent these and I can just use them, and if they work, great. If they don't, oh well. But like then one of my viewers, if they see me using it and they're like, oh, I need to go buy this $400 device, that's a little bit of a different story, right? And I want to make sure I'm either sharing that like I just use this for the fun of it, or I use it because it actually makes an impact on my life, right? So
That's why I'm actually sent stuff all the time. Like you can't see the table here, but it's like kind of full of stuff that people have sent me.
I imagine,
I'm very careful with what I like to endorse. This is a personal opinion, but I'm very careful with what I like to endorse, not only because I'm a dermatologist, but because I feel that social media as a whole is slowly moving toward becoming just a cesspool of ads. You know what I mean? Like there's just so many different ads out there. And sometimes it's from people I know speaking about things that I'm like, really? Like, do you love it that much, or is it just because it's an ad? And of course, it's helpful that the post says sponsored, right? So you kind of take it with a grain of salt. But at the same time, I think that we need to be very cautious with what we say online. And then for consumers, you need to be very cautious with what you believe when you
Absolutely.
hear about these things.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, being an influencer, like I definitely see both, I don't want to say both sides of it, but I think when I started out, like I was saving like any, I started on social media when I was like 13. So I was saving like, yeah, like any dime I could, any birthday money to buy like a drugstore lipstick. And I would do like so much research and watch so many reviews to make sure that like my $10 were being like well spent on like the best drugstore lipstick I could find, or skincare product or whatever it was. So, I get sent all this stuff. And if I don't love the product, I think me saying like, yeah, it's good, like someone might watch it and go spend their money on it, right? So I just have to think back to like my 13-year-old self when I would be saving up my money to be like buying that product, and now instead getting sent it, right? And on the other side of it too, like I do sometimes I love a product so much and I use it all the time, and then it just so happens the company wants to work with me on an ad, and then I do see like a lot of comments that are like, oh, like clearly this is just an ad, so you don't like this product, blah blah blah. And I'm like, no, but I actually have been, if you watch back my videos, you'll see that I've been using it for so long. And it's just like I've gotten the opportunity now to have it sponsored. So yeah, there's definitely, both sides to it. And I do think there's a lot of like overconsumption and all of that going on. But yeah, I think it is important. Some products, yeah, in the skincare realm of things, like there are some products and some devices and things that I'm like, you know what, this is just a fun tool to use, like the ice rollers and stuff like that, like the depuffing stuff. Like I don't think that I don't, say like, oh, I use this because it like changed my life, but it's more just something I like to add to my routine, more of a like self-care item that's relaxing or whatever. So I think, yeah, that's a good point to make, that differentiation between products for sure, because it adds up. They're all really expensive and
Yes, and there's always new ones, and
every day.
even the same one is just being remade version 2.0 or the updated 2024 version. So yeah, overconsumption can definitely be an issue. And in this is kind of a segue a little bit, but in this economy, right, where everybody's struggling a little bit, I do believe in smarter consumption and just really choosing what you buy. And it doesn't help that there's more ads than ever out there right now. But yeah, it's a thing we're all going through right now.
Absolutely. Well, that is our time for today, but thank you so incredibly much for making time in your busy schedule to sit down and talk with me. I learned so much from this episode, honestly. So I'm sure other
I'm
people
really
did
glad to
too
hear that.
listening. But wow, some really great tips in terms of like scarring and acne, and also like thank you for debunking some of the crazy comments I get too in terms of
Those are always so
skincare.
fun.
Do you want to let the people know where they can find you on socials and stuff?
Yeah, so my Instagram is where I am primarily. It's Danny Guo, so DannyGuo.md. Or you can find me on TikTok at Derm, DERM.TOK, Derm Talk.
Awesome. I'll have all of Dr. Danny Guo's social media down below in the description. You guys should definitely follow him. His content is so good. And of
Thank
course,
you.
it's just like really good quality. And honestly, like you just like have all the right information all there. And honestly, like I just want to say, because I've followed a lot of dermatologists and stuff, but you have like the whole creator thing down. Like
Oh,
you're
thank you.
editing. You're like lighting and setup. Like I'm like you're like a
This
professional
thing?
TikToker. Like all of it, and like your captions, and I'm like, wow, like this guy's a really professional social media person.
Thank you.
Wow, that's so awesome. But yeah, I'll have all the socials down below. You guys can definitely check them out because really great content. But thank you again so much for joining me on this episode.
It was an absolute pleasure to be here. I look forward to chatting with you again.
Absolutely. So to everyone listening, we post every single Sunday at 7 a.m. MST. Thank you so much for tuning in. And you'll hear from me in the next episode of Loud Talk with Bobby. Bye, everyone.